This announcement of the state of the vote by the President of the Senate shall be deemed a sufficient declaration of the persons elected, President and Vice President of the United States, each for a term beginning on the 20th day of January 2025, and shall be entered together with the list of the votes on the journals of the House and the Senate. Thank you very much.
Oh. Well, that was easy. Much easier when a Republican wins,
well,
eh?
I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me. Jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK, 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 in Santa Barbara, 93.7 in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, California. Also in California on KFOI in Red Bluff and Redding, and in Round Mountain on KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADRM, Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, even in 2025. On the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us. Hey, Wendell, I don't know if that submixer is up where it usually is. I sound a little bit low, at least to my ears, in any event. Oh, that's better, whatever you just did. Thank you. Hey, welcome to 2025. I am not even going to try to cover everything in the news today, including, well, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announcing that he plans to step down as Prime Minister after 9 years and as the Liberal Party leader, or the blizzard and fierce cold over the last day or so in the Midwest and in the South, now descending on much of the northeastern seaboard. Much less all that we have missed over the last couple of weeks while off for the holidays. Though I do hope to hit at least some of it today, and certainly in the days ahead as we try to get caught up. And if there's anything that you think must go out over your public airwaves, our public airwaves, please feel free to give me a call at 818-985-5735 if you are in our live Southern California listening area or listening anywhere across the globe via the kpfk.org web stream, as I do hope to get to at least some of your calls later this hour as well. But let's begin the new year here. You know, every time I mention Donald Trump as part of some news story, I end up feeling bad about it, like I didn't effectively carry out my job as a journalist. By failing to mention that, for example, he's a 34-time convicted felon, or that he's an adjudicated rapist, or that he was found by a bipartisan majority in the U.S. Senate after a trial there to have incited an insurrection against the U.S. government 4 years ago on January 6, 2021. It feels like mentioning him without the appropriate context that he was indicted in four different criminal felony cases since leaving office the last time is sort of letting him off the hook, a failure in my role as a journalist to inform the electorate. Does that make sense, Desi Doyen? I feel like I'm not hitting all of the things that I should be hitting to inform the public.
I agree, because I think it's something that folks really should be reminded of every time, because clearly, you know, corporate media has normalized Trump as, oh, just another politician, not somebody who just, you know, 4 years ago tried to overthrow the government.
And everything that he has done in between.
Yeah, of that context.
But really, and by the way, happy New Year's, Des.
Happy New Year too.
But really, you know, who can include all of the descriptive adjectives and the criminal background for this guy that we should somehow note every time that we report on him in order to try at least to educate the electorate in a way that you know, sure would have been helpful had the bulk of the corporate media at least tried to do so over the past 4 years, at least tried, and certainly throughout the last year's presidential campaign and into the run-up of the election itself. That would have been useful. In any event, it looks like I'm not the only one that is wrestling with that particular issue as we start the new year. Political blogger and activist Jeff Tiedrich, he took a run at solving that problem this way in his Substack newsletter over the weekend in a column headlined, "Cognitively Impaired Rage Baby Melts Down into Saddest Sad Ever." Writes Tiedrich in his lead over the weekend, "Somewhere inside his tacky Florida golf motel, Quadras indicted, twice impeached, once convicted, popular vote losing, Adderall huffing, insurrection leading, ear diapering, testimony ducking, judge threatening, lawyer ignoring, debate avoiding, witness tampering, day one dictatoring, disabled veteran dishonoring, inheritance squandering, rube fleecing, cloud makeup smearing, language mangling, sneaker hawking, serial sexual predating, draft dodging, casino bankrupting, butler bullying, daughter perving, hush money paying, real estate scamming, bone spur faking, ketchup hurling, justice obstructing, classified war plan thieving, golf cheating, stock manipulating, weather map defacing, war criminal pardoning, horse paste promoting, paper towel flinging, race baiting, tax evading, evidence destroying, charity defrauding, money laundering, diaper filling, 88 count, 78-year-old fluorescent tangerine narcoleptic fart factory is melting down into a molten puddle of woe is me." Well done, Jeff. Though perhaps I can now forgive myself for leaving out a thing or two whenever I try to accurately describe this guy in a news report.
Exactly. I mean, there's not enough time in the day.
But I think he did a pretty good job, to be frank. He goes on, "Why is Donnie Convict experiencing heretofore unknown levels of sad right now? It's all because that peanut farming Jimmy Carter had the temerity to up and die, and now the flags at Donnie's inauguration will be flying at half staff. So unfair. Check out this childish stuff," writes Tiedrich, though he used another word to describe one of Trump's weekend rants at his failed social media site that went this way just days after the 39th president of the United States had died after surviving brain cancer that he was first diagnosed with in 2015, before then going on to live 9 more years. So Trump wrote, quote, "The Democrats are all giddy about our magnificent American flag potentially being at half-mast during my inauguration. They think it's so great and are so happy about it because, in actuality, they don't love our country. They think only about themselves. Look at what they've done to our once great America over the past 4 years. It's a total mess. In any event, because of the death of President Jimmy Carter, the flag may, for the first time ever during an inauguration of a future president, be at half-mast. Nobody wants to see this," Trump writes, "and no American can be happy about it. Let's see how it plays out. Make America great again," said Donald Trump. As Tiedrich points out, citing the January 21, 1973 edition of the New York Times, the claim that this is, quote, "the first time an inauguration has had half-staff flags is a typically huge pile of Trumpian horse manure." Though, again, he used a better word that I'm not able to say on FCC radio. From the New York Times, quote, January 21, 1973, quote, Nixon inaugurated for his second term, sees world on threshold of a peace era. The president spoke from a temporary portico erected adjacent to the Capitol with the United States Marine Band and scarlet tunics arrayed before him. All flags on the Capitol were still at half staff in memory of former President Harry S. Truman, who died last December 26. Now, if you're keeping score at home, while Truman died on December 26 before the 1973 inauguration on January 20, Jimmy Carter reportedly died peacefully at his home in Plains, Georgia on December 29, 3 days later in the year than Harry S. Truman did the year before, who Nixon, as president at the time, had the decency to respect with flags at half staff nearly a full month later. In Trump's case, he can't do much about any of this because he is not, happily, not currently the president of the United States for at least another 2 weeks or so. As Tiedrich writes, did Tricky Dick whine about how the flags were hung? Of course he didn't. Nixon was a clinically paranoid criminal, but he wasn't an overgrown baby. Imagine such a self-absorbed diaper load that you make Richard effing Nixon seem statesmanlike by comparison. Donnie can stamp his feet and hold his breath until he turns blue and make threats about, quote, issuing decrees all that he wants, but the reality is he can't do squat. Though, again, he didn't say squat. The only person who can rescind that order to fly flags at half staff is the president, Joe Biden. Donnie is a private citizen right now. Until he takes the oath of office, he has no authority to decree anything. As my father liked to say, wish into one hand, poop into the other. See which one fills up first. He notes, I would put good money on a 100% certainty that as soon as he becomes president, Donnie will order those flags to be raised. That's what a power-mad narcissist does. But until then, rage on, little man, writes Jeff Tiedrich. Yep, we're back. And not a moment too soon, and not that I'm happy about it, but, well, here we are, and so are you. And if you would like to ring in on anything on your mind or anything that is on my mind today or anything that I don't have on my mind since we've been off for a couple of weeks, well, now's your time to call in and sound off in if you're in our local Southern California listening area or anywhere across the world via the web stream at kpfk.org. Our number is 818-985-5735. And since I have been off for a few weeks and trying to avoid the news, you may have stuff that you want me to know about. If so, let's do it. 818-985-KPFK. Bring it on in the new year. And speaking of Jimmy Carter, who will be laid to rest later this week, our Jimmy Carter setting the record straight factoid of the day. He installed solar panels on the White House. He urged Americans to turn down their thermostats while sporting a sweater, and he pressured Congress into putting tens of millions of acres in Alaska off limits to development. That, according to Maxine Joslow at Washington Post, back in early 2023, as Carter, who was then 99, 98 years old, announced that he would be entering home hospice care. He would eventually die at age 100, almost 2 years later. Despite serving a single term, Jimmy Carter ranks as one of the most consequential U.S. presidents when it comes to environmentalism, according to historians, conservationists, and former federal officials. As the U.S.'s 39th president from 1977 to 1981, Carter hung a map of Alaska in the Oval Office. It was where he made his biggest conservation mark, using his executive authority in 1978 to designate 56 million acres as federally protected under the 1906 Antiquities Act. At the same time, it was the most public land that any president in U.S. history had designated as off limits to development. And then weeks before leaving office, As if those 56 million acres protected wasn't enough, Carter also signed legislation protecting more than 100 million acres of land in Alaska. Carter will, quote, go down along with people like Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin D. Roosevelt as one of the greatest conservation presidents or environmental presidents of all time, said Douglas Brinkley, a presidential historian at Rice University. As his interior secretary, Carter chose Cecil D. Andrus, who vowed to crack down on industry influence over the agency, over the interior agency. Quote, the domination of the department by mining, oil, timber, grazing, and other interests is over, Andrus once told the New York Times. Perhaps he was a little bit premature with that declaration. And Carter pushed back against federal water projects, including those backed by members of his own party, on the grounds that erecting dams across the American West would harm the health of rivers. He targeted 32 projects of the Interior Department's Bureau of Reclamation and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The proposal, which became known as the Hit List, delighted environmentalists, but it sparked outrage among many Western lawmakers, including some fellow Democrats, who hoped to see the federal funds flowing into projects in their own states.
Now, Carter was absolutely right about the ecological impacts, the broad, very negative ecological impacts of dams, because not only are they going to destroy valued landscapes that have other ecosystem services that they provide, and that also increases emissions from dead vegetation that gets buried by a reservoir that is created by a dam, but also we are discovering in this time as climate change intensifies that drought in the West is proving to be too much for many of these dams. It's either that they are losing their capacity to build power, to generate power, like
because they're running out of water. There's not enough water because of the way that these rivers have been. As a matter of fact, Jimmy Carter lost this battle in a number of cases, but some of that battle did go forward. There was a compromise that ended up cutting funding for about 18 projects. It modified five others.
But he was right to start with, and that's the important point.
That's what Tom Kiernan says, the president and chief executive of the advocacy group American Rivers. He said that Carter was, quote, well ahead of his time in recognizing the threats to the nation's rivers, which are now being parched by a climate-changed-fueled megadrought. Kiernan said he was kind of the original river champion for this country. Even then, the politics were tough, however. It was a combat sport, if you will, and he stood up for the rivers. I know people, since his passing a few days ago, people have been talking about Jimmy Carter this and Jimmy Carter that. But there's a lot of details about this guy's life and his legacy that does not seem to make the top of the headlines that I think is worth noting, not just for what it says about Jimmy Carter, who served as president decades earlier, and who did great works since leaving office. But it also teaches us about the legacy of the presidency itself and how long certain decisions that are made by the president end up reverberating throughout history. An example, again, from Carter in Alaska, home to some of the biggest blocks of untouched wilderness in the country. The Washington Post notes that continues to define his environmental legacy even decades later. Despite losing the 1980 election, Carter successfully pressured Congress that year to pass the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA. Not a real catchy title, but that's what it was. The landmark law protected more than 100 million acres of Alaskan land, including national parks, monuments, and other sites. Alaska politicians and environmentalists have fought over one of those sites, the Izembek National Wildlife Refuge, for more than three decades, where Alaska lawmakers have sought to build a road right through it. Environmentalists have countered that it would fragment critical habitat for migratory bird, bears, caribou, and other species. Well, years later, Ryan Zinke, who served as the disgraced Interior Secretary for Donald Trump's first term, he signed a 2018 land swap agreement to allow the construction of that road after all. All of these years later, his successor, David Bernhardt, A coal lobbyist who Trump named to replace Zinke after Zinke resigned in disgrace, well, he made a similar deal the following year. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit upheld the that land deal in a 2-1 decision with two judges appointed by Donald Trump ruling, of course, in his favor. But in response to a request from environmental groups, the Ninth Circuit agreed to rehear the case. And as one of his last public acts, Carter took the unusual step of filing a brief just months before he would enter hospice care to voice support for the environmentalists. This is decades later. Bruce Babbitt, who served as Secretary of the Interior under President Bill Clinton, said it's remarkable that Carter took such an enduring interest in the issue. 41 years after he left the presidency, Babbitt said in 2023, Carter was still advocating for the environment and for Alaska. It's an extraordinary fact, said Babbitt. His environmental agenda also extended to the White House grounds, where he lowered the thermostat and famously in 1979 installed 32 solar panels as part of his push to save energy and curb America's dependence on fossil fuels. Quote, a generation from now, he said at the time, this solar heater can either be a curiosity, a museum piece, an example of a road not taken, or it can be a small part of one of the greatest and most exciting adventures ever undertaken by the American people. Well, Ronald Reagan decided it would be better for a museum, apparently, because he would remove those solar panels once he took office. Barack Obama, by the way, put new ones back a generation later. But in a move that proved more durable, the Washington Post notes Carter signed a bill creating the Energy Department. Did you know that? That Jimmy Carter created the Department of Energy? I didn't. It grew from a fledgling agency to today's sprawling network of nearly 14,000 employees at headquarters in Washington and 17 national labs nationwide. He also proposed tax credits of up to $2,000 for solar panels to heat homes' hot water way back then, and he called for renewable energy to make up to 20% of the nation's energy mix by 2000. But his energy plan ultimately failed to clear Congress, and an energy crisis in the summer of 1979, defined by long lines at gas stations, hurt his approval ratings and helped doom his reelection chances. But imagine had we followed that lead back in 1979. Imagine had those tax credits for the solar panels actually gone through Congress. Had we actually fought for that goal to have 20% of the nation's energy mix by 2000 be renewable energy? I don't even know how far along are we. Do you have any idea, Desi Doyen, how far along we are in that goal at this point for renewable energy?
I mean, it is improving, but right now we're only just now in 2024 reaching about 20% of electricity generation by renewables across the U.S. I mean, it's grown.
So 24 years after the target that had been set by Jimmy Carter.
Yes.
Carter would have done more to wean the country off fossil fuels had he won a second term, said Gus Speth, who chaired the White House Council on Environmental Quality during the Carter administration. Quote, he would have gone on in a second administration to tackle in a more explicit and serious way the reliance on fossil fuels and its link to what we now see as the climate crisis, said Speth. I think we've had some good environmental presidents, including the one we have now, he added, but I think Carter really felt it in his soul. Elections matter, as I suspect a lot of Americans are starting to realize now, and if not, they are about to find out, even if it may take generations to fully understand and come to terms with. And, in many cases, reverse the damage, if that is ever even possible. Jimmy Carter will continue to lay in repose at the Carter Center in Atlanta through Tuesday, with the public able to pay respects around the clock. He will lie in state in the U.S. Capitol until his funeral at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on Thursday this week at the Washington National Cathedral. All the living presidents have been invited. And President Biden will deliver a eulogy The Carter family will then return to bury its patriarch in Plains, Georgia, after a private hometown funeral at the Maranatha Baptist Church, where Carter, a devout evangelical, taught Sunday school for decades. Donald Trump, on the other hand, should consider himself lucky if anyone even feels like lowering the nation's flags to half-staff whenever he finally dies. Yeah, we're back. Did you miss us? 818-985-5735 is our phone number if you'd like to ring in with an answer to that question about missing us or a thought on the late, great Jimmy Carter. I hope to share a few more Carter factoids on the show as the week progresses. In the meantime, despite being convicted of 34 felony charges in New York and being constitutionally unqualified to hold the office of the presidency under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, for those of us who have eyeballs and can read, at least until the corrupt Republican U.S. Supreme Court majority that helped violate all congressional norms and traditions that Trump helped to violate those norms and traditions to install, until they pretended that the Constitution doesn't say what it actually clearly says about the disqualification of an insurrectionist to serve in any public office. Well, Donald Trump's second election as president of the United States was formally certified during a joint session of Congress on Monday at the U.S. Capitol as if to welcome us back from vacation. The ceremony was overseen by his Democratic opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris, in her constitutional role as President of the U.S. Senate, as she described in a short video that was posted to social media just a few hours before the session was called to order.
The peaceful transfer of power is one of the most fundamental principles of American democracy. As much as any other principle, it is what distinguishes our system of government from monarchy or tyranny. Today at the United States Capitol, I will perform my constitutional duty as Vice President of the United States to certify the results of the 2024 election. This duty is a sacred obligation, one I will uphold, guided by love of country, loyalty to our Constitution, and my unwavering faith in the American people. As we have seen, our democracy can be fragile, and it is up to then each one of us to stand up for our most cherished principles and to make sure that in America, our government always remains of the people, by the people, and for the people. May God bless you, and may God bless the United States of America.
It was Kamala Harris just before certifying Donald Trump to be the president of the United States. Once again, in 2 weeks, certifying the Electoral College vote based on how Americans voted on November 5th of last year. The certification of the Electoral College votes for president was carried out on Monday during that joint session of Congress. Within about a half hour's time, that's all it took, without incident or objection from Democrats or any Republicans who tried to overthrow the U.S. government 4 years ago by falsely claiming that the election had been stolen from Donald Trump. The certification of the 2024 election went forward without a mob of deadly Republican insurrectionists and terrorists attacking the U.S. Capitol. Donald Trump is now officially the president-elect, but he is also still a convicted felon. A New York judge on Friday upheld President-elect Donald J. Trump's criminal conviction on 34 counts of fraud related to hush money payments he made to a porn star to help him cheat to win the 2016 election. But the judge signaled that he was inclined to spare Trump any actual punishment for his crimes in what the New York Times described on Friday afternoon as a striking development in a case that had spotlighted an array of embarrassing misdeeds and imperiled the former and future president's freedom. Well, they weren't just embarrassing, New York Times. They were actually crimes, actual crimes, and he committed them, according to a unanimous jury. So please stop trying to soften his record, which is why he was able to win another election in the first place and arguably why he won his first election, thanks to coverage like that from the New York Times. The judge in the New York case, Justice Juan Merchan, indicated that he favored a so-called unconditional discharge of Mr. Trump's sentence, a rare and lenient alternative to jail or probation. He set a sentencing date of January 10. That's just 10 days before the lowering of flags for Jimmy Carter will be sullied by Donald Trump's second inauguration. And he ordered Mr. Trump to appear either in person or virtually for that sentencing. An unconditional discharge would nonetheless cement Trump's status as a felon just weeks before his inauguration. The Times is kind enough to note. He would be the first to carry that dubious designation into the presidency, even as it would water down the consequences for his crimes. By water down, they mean do away with the consequences entirely. It's nice to be king. Unlike a conditional discharge, they note, which allows defendants to walk free only if they meet certain requirements like maintaining employment or paying restitution, an unconditional discharge, the type that Donald Trump is believed likely to get this Friday, would come without any strings attached. The judge in the case, however, appears to have been left with few good options, so I don't hold it entirely against him. He wrote in an 18-page decision released on Friday, quote, "A sentence of an unconditional discharge appears to be the most viable solution to ensure finality and allow defendant to pursue his appellate options." Despite the leniency, Trump has already asked an appeals court on Monday to intervene to prevent or stay or postpone the sentencing while he appeals the Merchan's ruling on Trump's lack of immunity. While that plays out, the appeals court is unlikely to do that. In any event, he could be given up to 4 years in prison for his crimes, but he almost certainly will not. And yet he's still complaining to an appellate court. Justice Merchan declined on Friday to overturn the jury's verdict, rebuffing Trump's claim that his election victory should nullify his conviction somehow under the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court's ridiculous invention of a presidential immunity doctrine, which is nowhere to be found in the U.S. Constitution, nowhere, much less a pre-presidential immunity doctrine for crimes that he was found to have committed before he even became president, which is what is at issue here. Quote, "Essentially, what defendant asked this court to do is to create or at least recognize two types of presidential immunity, then select one as grounds to dismiss the instant matter," Judge Merchan wrote. "Binding precedent does not provide that an individual upon becoming president can retroactively dismiss or vacate prior criminal acts, nor does it grant blanket presidential elect immunity. This court is therefore forbidden from recognizing either form of immunity," wrote the judge. "To dismiss the indictment and set aside the jury verdict would not serve the concerns set forth by the Supreme Court in its handful of cases addressing presidential immunity, nor would it serve the rule of law," said the judge. "On the contrary, such decision would undermine the rule of law in immeasurable ways." He continued, "While this court, as a matter of law, must not make any determination on sentencing prior to giving the parties and defendants opportunity to be heard, it seems proper at this junction, to make known the court's inclination to not impose any sentence of incarceration, a sentence authorized by the conviction, but only the people, the New York prosecutors, concede that they no longer view that as a practicable recommendation." Merchan said that, quote, "A sentence of unconditional discharge appears to be the most viable solution to ensure finality and allow defendant to pursue his appellate options. Such a sentence would allow the conviction to stand, but without Trump being fined, locked up, or having to serve probation." And again, that's the ruling that he is appealing even today. Here, Justice Merchan writes, 12 jurors unanimously found defendant guilty of 34 counts of falsifying business records with the intent to defraud, which included an intent to commit or conceal a conspiracy to promote a presidential election by unlawful means, he wrote. It was the premeditated and continuous deception by the leader of the free world that is the gravamen of this offense, Merchan said. To vacate this verdict on the grounds that the charges are insufficiently serious given the position defendants once held and is about to assume again would constitute a disproportionate result and cause immeasurable damage to the citizenry's confidence in the rule of law. The judge added, the rule of law. Remember that, Donald Trump? Had you ever even heard of it before? It's unclear whether Trump plans to appear for the sentencing scheduled for this coming Friday, either in person or virtually. The judge left open the possibility of sentencing him when his term in office is done. That could happen, an alternative that had been suggested by the Manhattan DA. Justice Merchan said he found that option, quote, less desirable than imposing sentence prior to January 20, 2025. The reasons are obvious, the judge wrote. However, if the court is unable to impose sentence before defendant takes his oath of office, then this may become the only viable option. Of course, Merchan could impose a prison sentence on Friday and let a higher court sort it all out. But it does not look like he will. Unless Trump does not show up for sentencing on Friday to receive his literal get-out-of-jail-free card, in which case all bets might be off if he doesn't show. Anyway, your thoughts on that or anything else over the past couple of weeks when I've been trying to look the other way? Now's your chance to share them over your public airwaves. Perhaps your last chance before Trump takes office again and as his Project 2025 states specifically and literally on page 247 that the new administration should attack Pacifica Radio. The network should attack and defund Pacifica Radio, the network which, yes, airs the broadcast on dozens of affiliate stations around the country and kindly hosts the broadcast here at our flagship station, KPFK, in Los Angeles. 818-985-5735. I've been thinking about hopes and fears that many have as we head into whatever is coming next. And I got a lot of both, as I suspect you do too. So if so, I'd love to hear both your hopes and your fears moving forward as we are now 2 weeks away from the next Donald Trump inauguration. 818-985-KPFK. I've got some thoughts, but hopefully we'll get to your calls as soon as possible on our first broadcast of the new year. 818-985-5735. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is still the broadcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Looks like a lot of you folks want to get in. 818-985-KPFK. 818-985-5735. Your hopes, your fears, or anything else that's on your mind today. Haven't even gotten yet to the New Year's Day terror attacks. Both committed, by the way, by U.S. citizens. One of them was a huge Donald Trump fan, as he says in his letter, though for some reason, and hated Democrats, as he says in his letter, though the media has not been reporting that part of the letter. Maybe I'll get to it in a bit, but let me try to get to some of your calls first. Let's go to Larry in San Pedro. Hey, Larry, welcome to the broadcast. Happy New Year, sir.
Oh, thank you very much, Brad. Judge Juan Merchan, he was afraid his family or his daughter or himself would be murdered. And he was threatened by Trump thugs.
Mm-hmm.
His daughter was threatened by Trump thugs.
Yep.
And so he was intimidated. Mm-hmm. And I believe that that's why he came to the improper decision that allows Trump to be above the law.
Interesting.
Next, I just want to make a quick comment about Trump moving into the White House.
Mm-hmm.
This is unbelievable, Brad. He is going to be sitting behind the Resolute desk.
Yep.
And the media is not going to even mention the rape of Elizabeth Carroll.
E. Jean Carroll, yeah. Well, I'm the media. I'll mention it. I promise. I promise. It's my duty. Thanks, Larry. I really appreciate the call. Appreciate the thoughts. Hope you're well in the new year. And interesting about Judge Merchan having rolled over, as you argue, because he was concerned about the threats against him. I had heard about the threats, hadn't heard the argument that that's why he's making the judgment he's making. I have no evidence to support that, but I hear you, and it wouldn't be entirely unlikely at this point. Anyway, thanks, Larry. Appreciate the call, my friend. 818-985-KPFK. Let me go to Harold in Santa Barbara. Hey, Harold, welcome to the broadcast.
Well, thank you for bringing up something that I thought everybody forgot about, and that's the Constitution.
Yeah, remember that? I know it's a crazy old-fashioned thing to talk about the Constitution, and I know it's not in fashion to, you know, talk about it without making up stuff that is not actually in it. But I thought, you know, since I'm a conservative, I thought I would actually pay attention to what the words, the originalist, textualist words actually say in that Constitution. Anyway, I cut you off. Please continue, Harold.
No, you said it very nicely, and I keep forgetting that people don't have American government anymore. We used to have to take that class to graduate, and what made it worse, when I was a senior, usually they let the jocks slide, but my advisor, he had me snitched off every time I ditched, but now I'm glad I did not ditch.
I'm sure you did not. I'm sure you attended every single time. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for the call, Harold. Happy New Year to you, sir.
Happy New Year. And welcome back.
Thank you, brother. 818-985-KPFK. Let me go to John in Long Beach. Hey, John. Welcome to the broadcast. Happy New Year, sir.
Oh, hi, Brad.
Hi, John.
So I'm just hoping that the rift that has started to develop between the MAGA elites and these non-elected techie, you know, pharmaceutical billionaires club starts to broaden and widen and deepen this year, because obviously $250 million buys you some Trump airtime, but
yep.
I can't believe that, you know, Musk is lasted this long. I mean, in Trump 1.0, anyone who stole the limelight from him was, you know,
mm-hmm.
X'd out immediately. So we can just hope that...
But you know what, John? None of those people who turned against Trump or caused any problems for him during his first administration happened to be the richest man on planet Earth. And the lesson is, if you're Donald Trump, the lesson is you can do anything you want to Donald Trump if you happen to be the most wealthy man on the planet. That's how I read it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's unfortunate. I was at school with him in South Africa, and it was a rough school, and we were all beaten by the teachers, and he was thrown down the stairs by a group of boys, I think when he was about 13 or 14,
really?
Maybe, and yeah, so, I mean,
this
happens when abusers become abusers. People who are abused become abusers. You know.
This was so, Elon Musk at the same school you went to in South Africa?
Yeah, Pretoria Boys High.
And where, did you go there at the same time that he went there?
Yeah, I'm a year older than him. He was a sort of a freshman in high school when I was in my second year.
And you were beaten at this school?
Yeah, in South Africa, the teachers would beat us regularly with whatever they could find ready at hand. Canes, broken tennis rackets, you know, cricket bats.
Good Lord.
Squash, yeah.
Good Lord. Well, maybe that explains a thing or two about Elon Musk. Very interesting, John. Thanks for that. Thanks for that call. That's troubling. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it. Happy New Year to you as well. 818-985-KPFK. Again, nothing but men calling. Talk about the broligarchy. Nothing but men calling in. What's up with that? Where's my ladies at? 818-985-KPFK. Let me go to Mike in Los Angeles. Hey, Mike. Welcome to the broadcast. Happy New Year, sir.
Hello, Brad. So good to hear you guys again after the absence.
Good to be heard.
Yeah, there are a couple of things I think we should remember about the sentencing coming up. One is that this individual's lawyer served 3 years in prison for following his orders. His chief accountant suffered a 5-month term imprisonment for the same thing. And now he's walking free, apparently without even the opportunity to score the original accomplishment of giving a State of the Union address from a New York State prison cell, which I think would be a really good way to...
Yeah,
but
he could be signed, sworn in jail, right? There's nothing unlawful about
nothing
that.
Nothing to prevent it.
Yeah, and we could even
with modern technology.
And we could even fly the flags at half staff at the same time, just to remember who we're honoring here, Jimmy Carter. Anyway,
according to a very unreliable rumor, the director of government efficiency has decided that all Supreme Court pronouncements will be reduced by 75%, and that the first case of this will be the economia on the pediment of the Palace of Law itself, and it will lose the words equal and justice and law, and we'll just be left with under.
I wish that weren't actually as accurate as it actually is. I wish it was more of a joke than it actually is. Thanks, Mike. Hang in there, my friend. Happy New Year to you.
Same to you.
Thank you, brother. 818-985-KPFK. I had mentioned, so we had this this U.S. citizen who goes on this rampage in New Orleans on New Year's Day, kills 14 people. Injured about 30 others as he rammed his rented pickup truck, brandishing an ISIS flag into a crowded block of Bourbon Street in New Orleans in the French Quarter. Trump immediately goes out, disinforms his right-wing Republican supporters and dupes, and his propaganda outlets all join him in falsely attributing that terror attack by a U.S.-born citizen as a consequence of Joe Biden's immigration border policy, somehow, even though the man was born here in Texas, of all places. Now, President Biden is visiting New Orleans on Monday to meet with the first responders and the families of the victims in that very rough start for this new year. But that attack was followed within hours by an explosion in a Tesla Cybertruck parked just outside of a Donald Trump-branded hotel in Las Vegas, in which the driver of that rented truck, an active-duty Green Beret and U.S. citizen and hardcore Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and Bobby Kennedy Jr. supporter, according to the manifestos that authorities have since reviewed, he reportedly committed suicide as the truck filled with explosives was detonated. Again, a U.S. citizen, and a lot of people thought, well, this is obviously he's sending a signal. He's attacking a Trump hotel in a Cybertruck made by Tesla. Obviously, he's, this is yet another attack by some lefty Democrats against Donald Trump. Well, in fact, if you read what the guy says, he is anything but that. He's a Donald Trump supporter. He says, quote, military and vets move on D.C. starting now. Militias facilitate and augment this activity. Occupy every major road along Fed buildings and the campus of Fed buildings by the hundreds of thousands. Lock the highways around down with semis right after everybody gets in. Hold until the purge is complete, he writes. Try peaceful means first, but be prepared to fight to get the Dems out of the Fed government and military by any means necessary. They all must go, and a hard reset must occur for our country to avoid collapse. Masculinity is good, and men must be leaders. Strength is a deterrent and fear is the product. Stop obsessing over diversity. We're all diverse, and DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, is a cancer, this guy writes. Thankfully, he says, we rejected the DEI candidate and will have a real president instead of Weekend at Bernie's. Consider this last sunset of 2024 and my actions the end of our sickness and a new chapter of health for our people. Rally around Trump, Musk, Kennedy, and ride this wave to the highest hegemony for all Americans. We are second to none. Now, that seems noteworthy, and everyone has probably heard about this idea that, oh, this was not a terrorist attack, the nation is terminally ill, headed to collapse. But why haven't we heard about this guy actually saying we must rally around Donald Trump and Elon Musk and Bobby Kennedy? Why aren't we hearing about the fact that he's calling on militias to fight to get the Democrats out of the federal government and the military, quote, by any means necessary? Why haven't we heard about that? Seems odd to me. 818-985-KPFK. Let me go to John in Santa Monica. Hey, John. Happy New Year, sir. Welcome to the broadcast.
I'd like to talk about, I have two things, but the first thing would be about Jimmy Carter, because I think that's more important than all the ranting last half hour. Jimmy Carter, I have to honor Jimmy Carter for the Camp David Accords and Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat. And what's interesting is Jimmy Carter called the Zionist state an apartheid state, which was very accurate. And we're talking, what, 50 years ago when he did Camp David? I have to do my math. But Jimmy Carter did the biggest mitzvah, as it were, for Israel with that that Camp David Accord. And we're still paying, I think, Egypt about $3 or $4 billion a year, and then we pay Israel more than that, actually. But that was quite a service he did. And then his Habitat for Humanity, swinging a hammer and building homes. I don't know that we've had a president that has ever done that. And so Jimmy Carter has got Americans need to be very proud of that man. And I think his humanitarian, he came out as a humanitarian. He boycotted the Olympics when the Russians invaded Afghanistan. That was a very important thing he did there. And Jimmy Carter got a, you know, he...
I appreciate you, John. I appreciate you recognizing that when it comes to Jimmy Carter. How do you think Jimmy Carter's legacy post-presidency after serving one term, how do you think that compares to Donald Trump's post-presidency legacy over the past 4 years? As he's been hawking Bibles and sneakers and cyber bitcoins and all sorts of stuff and nonsense. How does that compare?
You're talking about his first 4 years?
Yeah. After his first four years. His post-presidency. Because I appreciate, John, I know you're a Trump supporter, and I appreciate the fact that you've recognized many of the positive points that you see in the Jimmy Carter presidency. And so I'm just wondering how you think that compares to what Donald Trump did after his presidency.
Well, what Donald Trump did was more on the economic realms. Well, first of all, he had no wars during his presidency, and I don't know how he did it, but he did it.
Let me answer that. Because he did have wars. He had huge number of attacks in Afghanistan and Iraq. He went after the military leader of the Iranian army. He upped the number of attacks in Afghanistan and Syria after the Obama presidency. So to say he had no wars is simply untrue.
He did not initiate the war in Afghanistan. He did not initiate the war in Iraq. And he did not surge with hundreds of thousands of troops and ammo. He wanted to get out of there. And so he is not a war president.
Well, actually, he did surge. He did surge with ammo big time. Name the number. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I could look them up for you, though. But yeah, he far outpaced the attacks when it comes with the drone attacks and so forth under the Barack Obama administration in his first 4 years. Not even close.
Barack Obama gave us the Libya catastrophe, the Syria catastrophe. Are you kidding? The Arab Spring with Hillary Clinton and Benghazi. Come on, are you kidding me? That is not even a comparison.
Yes, so, it is. You know, John, actually it is, because we're talking about simple numbers. What I said was that he increased the attacks, the drone attacks in Afghanistan, in Syria, and so forth when he took office. You can say whether that's a good thing or bad thing. I didn't make the case one way or another, but I said the numbers are what the numbers were. To say that he was not a wartime president,
he did not initiate any wars. Okay, let me revise my comment. You can't debate that. He did not initiate any wars. Joe Biden, let's put it this way. And I'll summarize with this. First of all, in one little.
Well, he actually attacked the military leader of Iran. Okay. Now, the fact that Iran did not shoot back, we should all be grateful for. But the notion that he was some great man of peace, who are you kidding, John? And we were talking about the post presidency. Well, we were talking about the post presidency. Can we stick to that? Because now I've only got a minute left.
He gave us the biggest tax. He gave the average worker like me the biggest tax break we've had in my memory.
Okay.
One, two.
Yeah.
He had more employment for women, Latinos, every minority had more employment.
Yeah.
And he had our border as sealed as it's ever been in many, many years. And by the way, Obama was deporter in chief, so don't throw that at me. I'll tell you what, I would like to make a comment.
You can't, because you burned up a lot of your time, and I'm already at the end of the hour.
Well,
I'm sorry, John.
You
can call it last time. Well, yeah, because it's my show, John. If you have your own show, you can rant for a half hour, and then I'll call in to talk to you. But the numbers, I kept asking you about post-presidency. You wouldn't ask that. I mean, you wouldn't answer that. But if you want to talk about the numbers during his presidency, compare him to Biden. Who has outpaced Donald Trump on every single one of those economic metrics that you just mentioned, John. Sorry, buddy. The numbers are the numbers. But I'm always glad to hear from you. Happy New Year's, John. All right, we got to get out. My thanks to everybody and my apologies to those who I could not get through to today. We'll try to open up the phones again soon. My thanks to our board engineer, Wendell Handy, to my producer, Desi Doyen, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. You'll find me on the social medias now, including Blue Sky at the Brad Blog. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
To the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.